is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
For me, the competitive component of practice is paramount. And then the next thing is really honing in on the stuff in the game that happens a lot and doing that.
Mark Christner is in his fifth year as the women's basketball head coach at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Christner has an overall record of 62-30 in his four seasons, including a conference record of 36-17. He has led the Knights to four consecutive trips to the MIAA tournament semifinals, and in 2023, he led Calvin to its first 20-win campaign since 2017. The Knights were nationally ranked for 11 weeks during the 2022-2023 season. His teams have achieved in the classroom as all four of his Calvin teams have received the MIAA Team GPA Award for posting a cumulative team grade point average of 3.30 or above. Christner spent the previous 9 years as head men's basketball coach at Waynesburg University. Prior to serving as head men's basketball coach at Waynesburg, Christner spent 8 years as an assistant coach with the Calvin men's basketball program and 3 years as an assistant coach with the Calvin women's basketball program. Mark graduated from Calvin in 1999, where he played 2 years on the Calvin junior varsity men's basketball team and 1 year on the varsity. Hey, Hoopheads, start the season off strong this October with scary good deals of up to $4,000 off the top training solutions from our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Prepare your team for success this preseason with spooky savings of up to $4,000 off Dr. Dish Basketball's shooting machines designed for schools and programs. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is Tyler Costin with Savvy Performance, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey, coaches, check out our newest sponsor, SportsLab 360, an online platform made up of interactive modules that focus on different tactical concepts, from the basics of reading a screen to specific offenses such as the dribble drive. Especially for our high school coaches out there with such limited practice time with your players, assigning the SportsLab 360 modules to them before practice can save you tons of time from having to stand there and explain these concepts. And you can move more quickly on to the next layer while your competition is still stuck on the fundamentals. As a coach, you can also put customized notes into the players' interactive modules, and you can track how they're scoring on the modules, making it a valuable tool to help identify areas that need development. These guys have had major success in soccer and just recently launched in basketball, and I'd urge all of our listeners to go check them out. Through October and November, you can use the code all lowercase hoopheads to save 15% off any SportsLab 360 plan. Head over to www.sportslab360basketball.com to check them out.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Grab your notebook before you listen to this episode with Mark Christner, head women's basketball coach at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. We are pleased to be joined by Mark Christner, the head women's basketball coach at Calvin University. Mark, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, Jason, it's good to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Yeah, I would say I was a driveway hoops kid. My dad didn't coach basketball. I had an older brother who was interested in hoops and being active. He was a runner. And we put up a basketball hoop when we moved. We moved to north central Michigan, Big Rapids, actually, when I was going into kindergarten. So I remember kindergarten, first grade, just shooting and being outside. In your mind, you're playing all those games of, you know, the Pistons were really good. So it's just kind of the beginning of Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars and Vinnie Johnson. So I likened myself as a guard. So you're out there playing imaginary games and kind of falling in love with the sound of the swish. And I just was out there a lot. And because I didn't have anybody else that really loved the game or pushed me to baseball or to football or anything like that, I just found a lot of freedom in doing it on my own. And you get into elementary school and into the public school program and just kind of work your way up. And I was fortunate enough to play a couple of years in college at Calvin. And you just have people pour into you. And here we are a long time later, still doing it.
What do you remember about some of those early coaches that you had and the influence that they may have had on you eventually leading to you getting into coaching?
Yeah. You know, I think Mike, whether it was a public school teacher, I remember Scott Dumas, was a baseball coach at Big Rapids High School. And he was like, he coached me when I was maybe in third or fourth grade. But I just remember the freedom, the creativity, the encouragement to play near the basket because you're a little taller or being a little bit more on the perimeter. And there was a point guard by the name of Sean Waters. It was Gary Waters. Gary was, you know, a longtime coach. He was a coach at Ferris State University. And then he moved up and was a coach at Kent State in Division I believe. And Gary's son, Sean, who ended up playing at Central Michigan, was a point guard at the high school when I was growing up.
I played against Sean back in the day at Kent State.
Yeah. And I mean, he was when I was like in fourth grade and you went to those Saturday morning camps, he was my coach. And he's probably the first guy I looked up to, like, wow, this guy could really play. And it was fun. And I just remember the enjoyment of doing that. So you have people, and honestly, Mike, probably one of the most impactful coaches I had when I was in high school was actually a cross country coach that I had for 2 years who was huge on running, playing, competing with heart. And he was probably the first guy that really demonstrated a vision of how to plan and prep a team for something to accomplish later in the year. It was really cool. And that was a sophomore in high school. And that was it was a vision casting moment that was really neat. So I think some of those things combined. Yeah.
How did playing multiple sports, running cross country, how did that influence you? I think one of the things that's always interesting with people that play other sports is just how you can pick up little things from those other sports that are more tangible than just, let's say, running cross country, especially if you're going to eventually end up in coaching. Playing multiple sports, you're much more likely to be exposed to different types of coaches. So when you think about your experiences as a multi-sport athlete, what do you remember? What do you feel is the benefits of that for you?
You know, running is so different because you are in different training modes and in different training seasons. You're not always maybe running at your peak all the time, right? You're trying to train and prep to be at your best a couple months down the road. And I think from a basketball standpoint and really from a coaching standpoint, being able to, my job is to look in March, right? We started last week doing some stuff, but you're looking at how good can my group get and what are some of the things that we have to be able to do and some of the people that we need to pour into to make sure that we can get there. And so I think that vision casting of running and of being a part of a cross country program in high school that was mildly successful, I would say, was really formative for me from a coaching standpoint. And I think at a younger age, probably middle school, high school, I kind of always thought that I would teach and coach in high school. And as situations changed, and I think the Lord provided opportunities. You know, I was able to get into college and stay in college. So I think there was always a sense that I wanted to coach and teach from a younger age. So you're kind of attentive to that. And I do think the multi-sport approach, every sport's so different in how they train and the types of things that are emphasized in different training segments I think different exposure to that when you're 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 and trying to figure it out was helpful from a coaching philosophy standpoint. And you just have different voices, right? You see different things. As you know, when you're around different coaches, you just pick up on a lot of different parts that can all help.
Everybody does things differently. You just have to pick out pieces of things that you're like, I like this. This is something that I would do. And then conversely, being around some coaches that you're like, maybe I wouldn't do that. And so you certainly learn what to do and maybe in some cases, what not to do. When you think back to your time as a high school athlete and specifically as a high school basketball player, do you have a memory or two that stands out specifically when you think about your time as a high school player?
I do. I have to say this, and John Vanderwall has gotten me over and over again. And I was at Waynesburg and we played Marietta, but I was a senior and John was a sophomore and we played against each other. John was from Cadillac, Michigan, and I played at Big Rapids High School. I did make a game winning shot over him to win the league. And boy, he put it on me when we were at Waynesburg a few times. So it was fine. And John's done a tremendous job at Marietta. It's been fun to follow him and to stay in touch with him and his family over the years. So, you know, you have those moments. We had a nice year, my senior year. We won the league and I don't know, we were maybe 19-2 and we probably got upset in the district semifinal by a guy who ended up playing at Oklahoma State, Brian Montanati at Muskegon Orchard View. But those are fun moments, right? Being able to make a shot, being able to make a play. I think as a basketball coach, you just want your players toward the end of the game to be able to make a play. It's usually something that breaks down and sometimes you have to throw one up and it goes in and it's pretty fun when that happens.
No doubt about that. There's nothing better than a buzzer beater. Coach, player, I think everybody, when you're on the winning side of that, it's always a good feeling. How about the decision to go to Calvin? And when do you have the idea that you want to try to play college basketball? When did that idea kind of get stuck in your head? And then eventually, how'd you end up at Calvin?
Yeah, it's a great question. Mike, I felt that I wanted to continue to play. When I was coming out of high school, there weren't a ton of options for me to continue to play. Calvin provided an opportunity, probably in the JV setting, right? You play JV. So many Division III's have reserve teams or JV teams that that student athletes can play on. And you know, I was able to play at Calvin there for 2 years, and then was able to work my way up to being a varsity player. My other option was to go to Xavier. In Cincinnati, and I just would have been a student. But maybe try to get involved from a basketball standpoint. And but I felt I wasn't done playing, kind of wanted to have the opportunity to continue to try to play. And at that time, Calvin had come off of a national championship in 1992, had a really good player by the name of Steve Hondard. And I watched Steve play on TV and in person, and he's just a fantastic player. And Ed Downlow was the coach and had a really long, pretty storied career at Calvin. And yeah, you know, it was just like, hey, why don't you come and see what happens? And Calvin was close to home. It's a really good school academically. So, you know, those factors all, I think as many guests have been on, Mike, you know, the small college world in the Midwest can be a really good place to play and to learn the game. And it's Calvin certainly provided that for me. And we had a great experience. I mean, now I would say after my first year, Coach Downlow left and then Kevin Vanestreek was hired. And I played another year of JV, Coach Vanestreek's first year. And then I was on the varsity team as a junior. And then that spring postseason meeting, Coach Vanestreek suggested that maybe my talents could be better served as a student assistant. It was kind of a towel waiver, didn't get in it, play a ton, but he also, I think, recognized, and we had chatted that maybe I had a desire to want to coach at some point. And he suggests, he goes, yeah, but just think about it. Right. So you think about it over the summer. And I kind of figured, well, if I was going to sit the bench anyway, might as well make a little money as a student assistant to do it and learn the game differently. And honestly, it was one of those things that, maybe changed the trajectory of my life in terms of how I got into coaching and the types of people that I met and the types of experiences that I had. So, really, really grateful for that moment. And so while the desire to not continue to play I wanted to play, but I was just not going to get an opportunity really to play, just with the talent that we had. And it was kind of the beginnings of a group that would eventually win a national championship again at Calvin in 2000. So, but to be a part of, coach's life, and he's been a tremendous mentor to me for 20 plus years. And I'm really grateful for that friendship. And, so that was really neat. So it's interesting how things end up working out in the end, usually,
Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes it's one of those cases of maybe it wasn't something that you were necessarily 100% thinking about at the moment, but once he brings that to you and you get that opportunity, I think one of the things that's always interesting to me is when you think about transitioning from, okay, you're a player in the program to you're a coach in the program. And obviously you're still a student at that time. So it's not completely where, okay, you went from being a player to now you're full-time and a coach on the staff in that way, but you're still transitioning where you go from a player. Now you have sort of a different relationship with your head coach. It's no longer a player coach relationship. And also then you're talking about guys that you had played with the year before that now you're on the sidelines coaching them. So what was the transition like for you? And what do you remember about just trying to get, I don't know if comfortable is the right word, but just trying to make that adjustment from I'm a player to now I'm a coach?
The good question. Coach was great. And we had two other assistants, Tim Van Dyke and Chris Fear at the time. And I really worked with Chris on the JV front with JV guys. And I lived with two captains on the team. So, we go home and you really try to, I think one of the things that I really learned though was the loyalty component and just the conversation, right? And how you can steer conversation away from talking a lot of shop and talking maybe big picture, right? So we kind of sat in the coach's office and you're planning out practice and you're planning out rotations and you're thinking about long-term things. And I was an observer. I was a listener. They would ask opinion and I would give it to a degree, but really those three guys knew what they were doing and they were kind enough to offer me a bone every once in a while and ask what I thought. And then you go home and you're having mac and cheese or ramen with, guys that were in practice. And,
right.
So that part to me was a really early lesson in separating, and that has transitioned as I've become married and had a family. And I think as coaches try to, I know Marcus Freeman at Notre Dame talked about a work-life blend. You end up segmenting, right, your life a little bit and you have to be able to compartmentalize and not share everything with everybody. And I think the sensitivity to what goes on in practice and how that gets disseminated to some of that information of who's playing and who's not playing well and what's going on with this person or what's going on with, when you live with people who are on the team, you really have to honor that well. And that was a really good lesson for me to honor that well. And we did. And so but then I was the next year I moved on. Didn't move on, but I just jumped onto the women's side as an assistant because Kim Gall was hired at Calvin. And, so that year that the guys won the national championship in 2000, I was a women's assistant for the first year. We made the Sweet 16 and got beat at Wash U by Baldwin Wallace, actually, in double overtime. But those 2 years are really, really cool. I mean, just the ability to live it in certain ways, like with great friends and roommates, and also as a member of the staff. Great lessons that I think helped pave a way to allow me to be a better coach, maybe earlier than I would have ordinarily.
So what does the conversation look like when you graduate and finish that year as a student assistant? The women's job comes open. What'd you think about that opportunity? Had you ever thought about coaching women? Just what was your mindset there as you're like, okay, I'm playing in the program, I'm a student assistant in the program, now I'm going to jump over to the women's side. Just what was your mindset like at that point? And obviously you had talked about how earlier you kind of had envisioned yourself maybe being a teacher and a coach at the high school level. So just talk about the decision to take that job, how that opportunity opens up, and just kind of where you were mentally at that point.
Yeah. So initially I was looking for a teaching job. You get the degree. I did one of those, but I also had a half year scenario. So I did have to student teach yet. And so that played into it just a little bit, but I think like most young people who are trying to get into the game, you feel like you have a couple options. And early in the summer, I remember a friend of ours was hired at a local high school, and he was going to need an assistant, and I was going to high school in Grand Rapids, and I was going to go be an assistant with him. Well, then he, for various reasons, didn't end up like actually taking that job. And so that opportunity went away. And so then you're continuing to look for other opportunities within the high school world. And Grand Rapids is a decent size metro area, but it's not, you know, the size of Chicago or Los Angeles or anything. There's not like a plethora of opportunities. And the Calvin women's job, Kim Gall got hired a little later in the cycle. So she got hired at Calvin probably early, like May, early June maybe. And so my name was given to her as a potential assistant by another member of the athletic department at Calvin. And so then it was a process of getting to know her and seeing if that could be a fit. Because again, I would be coaching people that I was classmates with, which is a little different. And yet it worked out really well. And eventually decided to take that job. I coached my own team then too. The coaching of the JV team that year was part of that job. And made a little extra money. It wasn't much as I remember, but it was an opportunity to end up coaching 15 to 18 college games. And I do think, Mike, at the end of the day, and Coach Vanderstreek was great with this. I just think, you know, he saw something in me that maybe I didn't see in myself, and staying in college. And then I just remember thinking that summer, I'd like to try to stay in college for as long as I can. Not that high school would be a default, because I know so many men and women who have done remarkable work at the high school level for a long time. And high school coaches are awesome people. But I just remember thinking, if I'm here, if I can stay in college, that would be really cool. And I didn't think much of whether it was coaching men or coaching women at the time, honestly. The women's opportunity came open, and there wasn't an opportunity maybe with Coach Vanderstreek to continue after being a student assistant. So it was just a way for me to continue to stay in college and have a little bit of a different experience, which I wouldn't have known, but 18 years later was really impactful in me coming back, I think.
What did you initially really enjoy about coaching on the women's side? Did you find it to be the same experience in terms of kind of what you expected, what they expected from you? Was it different? And what about it did you really enjoy in your first experience with it?
I loved having my own team. And while I was still pretty young, I felt like you worked to do the summer camp circuit at the big schools. You know, went to Michigan and worked Michigan camp probably 5 or 6 summers in a row. Coach Vanderstreek actually had a recruiting camp that he worked, that he owned, continued to own when he moved to Grand Rapids. He came from the University of Sioux Falls in South Dakota, and a guy by the name of Clay Mosier, who has been in the G League and I think is a must assistant now at Arkansas, had a recruiting camp prior to the mass AAU component. So I worked that camp in Sioux Falls with Coach for a lot of summers, but you get a team and you just coach high school games. So you coach 12, maybe high school games a week. They had a week of guys and a week of girls. So if you were a coach for 2 weeks, you coach 24 high school games, like legit high school games with officials and the whole deal. And so you feel like, I felt like I had some coaching experience and then the ability to then interplay that in a college setting at Calvin was pretty neat that first year with Kim. So I found the women to be attentive. I think they were eager learners. And we just had a lot of fun. I think generally that group, and I don't think it was any different at that time from the men's group, but there was just a work ethic component that we didn't have to teach. And so you knew that they were going to come and play as hard as they could. And there's some things athletically that obviously are different, but the game's the same. The competitiveness is the same. And you're trying to put players in position to be successful. And yeah, so that part was really enjoyable. And I think to be able to do that, you know, when you're 21 years old, it was great. And I'm really thankful for that. And, you know, you learn how to interact with officials and make sure that, when you're doing small college JV or reserve games, you're making sure the book's right. You are making sure that the numbers all line up. You're everything. You're driving the 12 passenger van back when we could put 12 people in 12 passenger vans. So yeah, and you're coaching and you're drawing stuff up and you're trying to figure it out. And so that was really, really cool. And I'm grateful for that. So, but I just remember we had a lot of fun. I think we were probably about 500 and you know, you're trying things out and you're seeing how your communication style as a coach, your ability to motivate as a coach, how all that stuff plays.
All important when you look back are those reps that you were getting as a head coach, because I know that one of the things that I've had coaches tell me on the podcast, and I experienced this to some degree when I started out my first 2 years, I was the JV coach at a high school and I made a lot of in-game decisions and kind of got that experience. And then I was a varsity assistant coach for probably 10 years before I took on for a year. I was the varsity assistant coach and our JV coach had left and I also coached JV. So I went from like 10 years of not making decisions about who's going to sub and when I'm going to call a timeout and having the clipboard in the huddle. And I know that in those 10 years that I was out, my skills at those head coaching tasks in game were pretty rusty. And so I think one of the things that coaches always say is that getting those reps early on in your career as a head coach, or even guys who start out coaching AAU games, it's just like, hey, I coach 70 AAU games in the summer. And just the opportunity to do that and be the person making those decisions. I know guys have talked about how invaluable that is. So how do you think about those things in terms of how that eventually impacted you when you did get to become a head coach?
Yeah, Mike, it's incredibly valuable. Your ability to, I think, control yourself on the sideline becomes really important. And the types of things that you say to your players, you say to officials, how your body language screams or whispers, you say that to your players, but yours is the same, right? It's the same thing for you. Like you're modeling what it is, and you can be as upset as you can be. And there's certainly times to be upset and to put a forceful point across. But when you're down 22 in the locker room at Muskegon Community College, I don't know if throwing a temper tantrum is going to help your team get back in the game. I think you need to be able to identify what's going on and then play people that are going to do what you want them to do. And I learned that so early, and it was continually reinforced that I felt like when I had a chance to be a head coach at Waynesburg in, in 2010, like I had felt like I had coached, you know, probably upwards of 350 games between the JV games that I coached at Calvin on both the men's and the women's side. And then it's just working those camps. And so, yeah, it took me 4 or 5 years to get my first technical foul, right? And you're showing and you're trying to demonstrate to your players that there aren't any excuses. And I have to figure it out. I mean, with my staff and some of those things. So I think that was great. And it's not something that I will forget. I think, and it would encourage coaches to, sometimes I know people, I was hoping to be a varsity assistant and not coach the freshman team or a sub varsity team, but yeah, man, put the prestige aside. And if you have an opportunity to coach games, you learn so much about yourself. You learn a lot about how you relate and motivate and prepare. It matters. And I think a lot of people, I'll say this and maybe you'll come back to it, but when I was first hired at Waynesburg, I came from Calvin, obviously, in the region. I don't know how comfortable this guy would want me to share this, but we were hired in another Division III in the region of Pennsylvania, hired same cycle, came from the UAA as an assistant. And we got to know each other pretty well, and we would scrimmage one another, kind of similar pedigrees, in terms of you come from a place that's used to winning, and then you're at a place that hasn't won in a while. And I remember this coach just telling me when we'd sit probably 3 years into it together, 4 years into it as head coaches, of how he didn't have any idea how hard it was. And I don't know all of his experience leading up to when he was hired at the school that he was at, when we got to know each other pretty well. But I think there's a tendency sometimes to think that coaching is it's easy, right? Or it's easier. It's not what you think. And small college work is super rewarding, but it's also a hard pull sometimes. And having all that experience of coaching and those games and those moments, it's just one thing that I don't have to worry about how I'm going to react, because I've felt like I've had practice doing it for myself. And so for me, like my own self-control, the ability to kind of center myself back on what's really important as the game is going on, I had figured that out by the time I got to be a head coach. And that was a gift that I'm really thankful for.
Yeah, you learn, I think, who you are as a coach, because I know that sometimes when you sit on a bench as an assistant coach and you ultimately are not the person who makes the decision or the person that has that decision attached to their name, it's easy to, I think, sometimes as an assistant, and we've heard this in various conversations with guys, Mark, that they'll say, as an assistant, I would tell my head coach, hey, you should do this. And it seemed like there was really no other choice. Like you couldn't even fathom as an assistant why the head coach would make a different choice other than the one that you were suggesting. And then guys would say, once I got to be a head coach, I understood that there were lots of different shades of gray, different angles and ways that you could look at it, or things that would be impacted as a result of this decision. And it was never a black and white decision. There were many more nuances to it, and sometimes you just don't see that as an assistant. I think that I can say with all honesty that during the 10 years while I was not coaching games as a head coach, I was just the assistant coach. I think you kind of lose sight of maybe how difficult it is to be a head coach, because ultimately you're not making those actual decisions that, as I said, they're not actually attached to your name. If you make a suggestion and your head coach takes that suggestion, if it goes well or it goes poorly, it's probably not coming back to you. For sure, if it goes poorly, it's not coming back to you. It's going to fall upon the head coach. So I just think that, yeah, to be able to get those reps early on in your career to me is obviously tremendously valuable. You were able to deal with that when you got the job at Waynesburg. Before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about the transition from the Calvin women's program back to the men's program. How does that happen when the opportunity opens up for you there back in 2002 to come over to the men's side as an assistant? And just what did you learn in those 8 years as an assistant with the men's program at Calvin?
The opportunity to go back and work with Coach Vanestreek was It was great. And Kevin is, he's a great friend of mine. You know, I really felt, and I think when I went to the women's side initially, I think there was probably an idea that maybe we would, if there was an opening on back on a staff and that, and it worked, then he would look to hire me back on that side. And yeah, it worked out. Tim Walker was Kevin's assistant, and Tim got the job at Trinity Christian in Chicago, near Chicago in 2002, and was able to jump back over and work with Kevin. And I think to be able to work with not only someone that is a high achiever at his craft, which Kevin certainly was, but also turned into be a really good friend. We spent a lot of time. We'd drive out to Sioux Falls together in the summer. Then you spend a couple weeks together and then you drive back. It's about a 12-hour drive one way. And you just end up spending a lot of time outside of basketball and the pressures of the game. And you get to know somebody. And I think our values line up pretty well in terms of how we want to live our life and the types of things that are important to us. And, you know, we really struck up a friendship. And I would say one lesson too, Mike, like when I played for him that junior year, I would not have ever guessed that our relationship would have blossomed into something that it is now. It's something I'm really thankful for. We certainly weren't, you know, we didn't butt heads or anything of that nature. It just wasn't on the radar when I was a junior in college that, you know, I would go back and work with him in that stretch of time, but also then he would be so instrumental in me and my professional life moving forward after that. And so his friendship has been a great gift to me and then to our family. But I think, and we had a really nice stretch of time together. I think every year we either won the league or were playing in the conference tournament final, and we had really good players and really, you know, we were in the Final Four in 05 and got beat on a last second shot by Rochester in the semis. And, you know, but that was a cherry on top to the, I think, to the relationship piece of building. And what's been really neat is now 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years later, we have guys that are sending their daughters to our summer camp at Calvin that I coached in that stretch of time. And that's incredibly awesome. And I think, you know, Kevin's been a big part of instituting some of that family and that pieces of culture throughout Calvin basketball. And yeah, I was really grateful for the opportunity that I had to work with him during that stretch of time.
That second generation stuff is really cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. Yeah. I mean, we're almost to the point where, you know, we're probably a year or two away from really actively recruiting some guys that I coached their daughters, you know, in that stretch of time. So that's pretty cool.
During that time as an assistant, did you feel like there was a point where you clearly felt ready to sort of pursue your own program? What was your process for finding the right job?
Yeah, Kevin gave me a lot of responsibility. So I mean, I was coaching the JV team during that time, but I was teaching some classes at Calvin, some kinesiology classes, but we also was helping with schedule. It was back in the day when every small college assistant knew the university's FedEx number, because you're sending physical tapes or then CDs in the mail for film exchange. So I was in charge of that. We did a tip-off tournament that we hosted, so I was in charge of that. And so, you know, you felt like you had a lot of responsibility. Had some on-the-floor stuff with wing players and guards. Had a pretty good say in some of the things offensively. And yet, as you said, Mike, you're not the head guy. So you are suggesting, and when he ignores it, you're not offended at all. Maybe you're relieved. It wasn't me. but I think probably about halfway through. So, you know, 06, 07. So coming off of the Final Four year, and then the next year, we had another really nice year and got in the NCAA tournament again. And I think at that time, you kind of start looking around. And I would say regional, small college, Calvin's a Christian institution. So there was the missional part of that could be attractive, right, to certain schools. And I knew I wanted to be, I've always been a Division III person. So not that I wouldn't have gone to Division II if that would have worked out or anything of that nature, but I felt very comfortable in the Division III world. And at that point, you know, Calvin had it rolling pretty good. So I think what we were doing was maybe allowed me to get in the door some places. A lot of cover letters, a lot of form letters back. Hey, thanks for your interest. But you don't hear anything else. And I ended up with two interviews in person at the third phone interview before the Waynesburg job opened, right? So there were probably 18 schools from 2006 through 2010 that I applied to or that Kevin inquired on for me on my behalf. And so that was kind of my process. And, you know, you're in prayer about trying to find the right one. Every time there was one that looked like it could be the one or attractive, you know, we had a young family at the time, and my wife was fully committed and continues to be fully committed to me and to my profession a little. And, you know, she's in it too, as much as I am, like looking at what it would be like to live there and what does this look like for our kids and some of those types of big life questions. So, yeah, but I think the right thing happened, and the opportunity to go to Waynesburg was really a great one at a great time, I would say, for our family. And I think it worked out okay.
What do you remember about the interview process and some of the questions that they asked you and some of the questions that you asked them? Because obviously, I think one of the things that as a coach, you're always trying to do is clearly you want to get an opportunity, but you also want to get an opportunity at a place where they're going to give you the resources to be able to be successful. So just talk about kind of the two-way street of them asking you questions and you asking them questions.
It was a really interesting place, and because in the NAIA world, when the mid-80s, Waynesburg was really good. They had gotten to the Final Four in Kemper Arena in the mid-80s a few times, and Rudy Marissa, who was the longtime coach there, was very well known in that area, in that small college circle during that time. And he was the AD when I was hired, and maybe 5 days after I was hired, he announced his retirement. And I remember getting a few text messages about running the AD off less than a week on the job. I think that was in play before we went in there. But I do think, Mike, like there had been some success there before. And while it was in a different time period and a different era, I felt like it was worth a shot because the town was small. There wasn't a lot. I mean, we were 20 minutes north of Morgantown, West Virginia, and an hour south of Pittsburgh. So actually kind of a cool place to live. And they hadn't had a lot of recent success. And so felt like with some renewed energy and purpose, we had talked about, it was a place that had a rubber floor. And so I remember on the interview process talking about that a little bit, but also not, you know, honing in on it to the point that you wouldn't take the job. But 3 years after I got hired, we got a wood floor, right? So I think there was some investment that it was like, hey, we're going to try to make this happen. The previous coach at Waynesburg was part-time, so my position would be full-time. So already institutionally, we kind of understood that they were trying to make some strides based on what they felt like they could do to make it a little bit more appealing. And I felt like it was a league in the President's Athletic Conference that Grove City had won the league the year before, but there wasn't a dominant force or two coming from the MIAA, where Calvin and Hope had really been, you know, the two main programs in men's basketball. just kind of looking at that landscape in the President's Athletic Conference, kind of felt like maybe we could do something and get in there and have a chance to compete. So those are the questions that you kind of ask right away. Like, where do kids come from? Why do they come to Waynesburg? What's appealing? Because I was not from the area. I didn't originally, I had no experience of living there. So what was drawing general students there? What was the basketball scene in and around Pittsburgh like? We were 2.5 hours from Cleveland. It's a really good place to be a small college basketball coach, because you can get to a lot of places. You get to 3.5 hours from Washington, D.C. and the DMV. You kind of look at those things, and then it just became an investment piece. And I think as an institution, I think they felt like they were making the position full time, by understanding that they needed to get a wood floor. I think we were progressing to a point where, as a young coach looking for an opportunity, it ended up being a really good fit. And I think missionally, Waynesburg also was a Christian college that was trying to come back to its Christian roots a little bit. And so coming from Calvin, that was a good fit from my standpoint. And I think it was an attractive piece for them. It worked. We had 9 really, really fun, strong years there. And you always want to win more. But at the end of the day, I think the guys that we had there that played for us, I'm still in touch with a bunch of them. And it's really neat to see what they're doing and what they continue to do now and with their families and with their professional lives.
How long did it take you to get that program to where you felt like it was running the way that you wanted it to run? In other words, you come in and obviously you're inheriting a roster and you've got some things that you want to do with this first head coaching opportunity. When do you feel like you had it? Again, not that you had everything figured out, but when did you feel pretty comfortable that, like, hey, this program now looks kind of like how I want it to look?
Midway through the third year, I would say. Like, honestly, we had a long losing streak program-wise to Bethany College in West Virginia, and Andy Sachs was the coach there at the time, had done a really nice job. And we beat them in February of that year, kind of midway through the third year. And it was a year that we ended up winning about 10 games. And I think, like, for me, like, that was a point where they're like, hey, we can compete with and beat actually one of the best teams in our league. And from that point, the next year we were able to win 15 games. The year after that, we won 18 and were second in the league and lost in the conference tournament final at St. Vincent. And I think, I know it was hard. I know it took a lot of time and effort, right? I mean, we had a staff. Mike Fatigani was my first assistant coach, and then Mike left after year 4 to go be a high school coach at the high school that he taught at. And Mike played at Mount Union for Lee Hood, and was a great addition for me. He was super balanced and smart, and knew how to get to guys a little bit. Like, he had just a little bit of a survivalist mentality, because he was one of 18, I think, that Lee brought in one year, and ended up being one of 3 guys that walked on senior day, for Mount Union's program. And then we were able to bring back a former player, a player that was on our team my first year, Ben Altmeyer, who was with me for 4 or 5 years and did a great job. And Ben's a good friend of mine. And, we felt like we could, have a little balance there. I would say this, though, Mike. I think the one thing, and this is what I've tried to bring in, because I feel like I'm about the same spot now back at Calvin as I was in that time at Waynesburg. I probably didn't realize how tired I was. And, we won 18 games. It would have been 14-15, and then 15-16, we had 7 or 8 returners coming back from that team that won 18 games. And so we had gone, like, hey, I mean, you'd done the latter, right? You did 5, 4, 10, 15, 18. And you're like, ooh, man. And I And I learned a hard lesson. I really felt like we had our culture in a good place. And I just remember being really exhausted in the summer and just kind of thinking, you know, we got eight guys back who were part of, have been a part of this. And, you know, they entered in a little bit higher, but it was still like 10 wins. Like it was still tough sledding a little bit. They got it. And, you know, they didn't have it. And I didn't do a very good job of helping them with it culturally. We got off to a poor start the year after that. We ended up winning 10 games, probably should have won a couple more because I think we started 0-8. But that idea that you're really pushing, and then the sustaining part of the program, to me, and that set us back a little bit of time there. That's, I don't have a lot of regrets about coaching, but that is a big one. And I do wish we would have been able to do that a little differently. But the sustaining of, it probably ends with results, but I think more culture and how you're going to operate was something that that summer probably slipped a little bit from, certainly from my standpoint and from my, as I'm leading that program. And it was hard to get it back after that. It was probably inconsistent. And that's one thing that now I've learned is we've changed and been here and I'm entering year 5 years. So a little more attention to that component. And when someone like Josh Loeffler talks about culture being an ecosystem, and I know people use a lot of those analogies. Yeah, I know exactly what they're talking about.
So if you look back on that time where you felt like it kind of got away from you, now you're at a similar point as the women's coach at Calvin. You've got to sustain, as you talked about. What do you think are the keys to sustaining your culture as opposed to kind of letting it slip? I mean, obviously letting it slip sort of means that you're not paying as much attention to detail, but sort of on the positive side, what are things that you feel like you can do, you are doing, you will be doing to maintain what you've built in order to get to the point where you want to be?
One thing that we're doing this year that I really like, and one of my assistants, Heather Swearinga, who's with me now, suggested it over the summer, but we're doing little, we call them culture labs. So we are using the Division III legislation allows us to use now eight practices outside of our traditional time period, which is usually right around October 15 when we start. So I know places have started earlier than us, but we started just Monday, October 2, and we're doing three sessions a week for 2 weeks, and then we'll kind of get into our normal schedule. So we have four of those sessions. We are ending with a culture lab, and we are talking about our pillars, and we are using tangible examples to define and show our current team what it looks like in real life. And we had done that. I mean, you do it differently probably every year, but I think initially when I was a younger coach and I thought, hey, we have eight guys returning. They have been there and you're touching base with them and you're talking about it. But from a standpoint of how hard you're going to work and how you're going to approach your work in the weight room, in the classroom, collectively, to how authentic you're going to be as a teammate, to just mentally being ready to go. And yeah, those things I let slip. And we're going to try really hard to not have that happen. So we're kind of redefining. We have a group this year that has, we have nine returners, but they're all folks who I would say had played roles over the last 2 years. We have one starter back from a year ago and we have nine new players. And so there's just a lot of new faces. And so to be able to define the terms that are important to us, give real life examples and have it be a pathway to greater conversation as the year goes on was something that I'm really excited about, and probably one way that I have that 2017 year in my mind, right? That's kind of motivating to not let that happen again.
When you think about leadership on your team, especially at the Division III level, when you talk about the limited contact you can have with players outside of the season and having them get better and work, how do you think about developing leaders on your team? Do you have a formal process for that? How do you approach that as a head coach?
The relationship piece is enormous. The trust that we develop over time, the player and I, that is the most important thing. And I think as you identify the strengths of your team and who embodies the things that you value, and as you talk to people, and I probably find this more on the women's side than on the men's side in my experience, women might be a little less apt to want to lead. And so I think you have to ask them. If you see characteristics in them that you can draw out of, I think asking them is the best way to do it. What do you think your leadership qualities are? Where do you want to lead with this team? Do you want to lead with this team? I think when I was a younger coach, I probably just assumed that guys would want to lead for the people that gravitated toward being a starter, or that were your best players, or that gravitated toward a big group of people and kind of felt like they liked having a voice, were the people that maybe would be your best leaders. Well, they're influencers. They might not be leaders, but they influence. And I think as I've learned, the relationship that we have with our players needs to include conversation about what they want to do, and B, what they feel really good about doing. And you try hard to not overload somebody's plate, but you want to put in front of them some things that maybe they don't see and maybe that they would like to think about. And so to me, that's all part of the relationship that goes between coach and a player. And you have to ask them questions. We do try to follow the Brené Brown, clear is kind, unclear is unkind. Like we just ask them. And as we go through some of our leadership curriculum as a team or as our, in our culture labs, you can see and hear what people have to say, the types of things that they are suggesting. You're always trying to identify younger players that you feel could grow into a leadership role. And then you have an opportunity to have dialogue with them about leadership without them even thinking about being a leader, because you maybe identified it as a freshman. And so by the time they're a junior, you've maybe already had 2 years of conversation thinking in your mind that they could be a leader. And then your conversation cements that, yep, they would be really good, or nope, we probably need to go in a different direction. And I think that's clear communication, and it's something that takes a lot of time, but yet it's incredibly invaluable.
Okay, so two questions off of that. First part of the question is, what are some areas that you look for players' leadership in? In other words, what are areas where you feel like it's important to have someone from your team be a leader? And then number two, as you're going through and you're thinking about that as a coaching staff, trying to identify which players you feel could fit in those areas, you talked about communication. What does the communication look like in terms of, you said it's a lot. When does that communication take place? Is that conversations that are going on the practice floor, before practice, after practice, in the locker room? Is that a formal sit down? Is that going and having lunch with the players? What's that communication look like? So what areas are you looking for leaders in? And then how does that communication between you and those players take place?
Yeah, the areas of leadership include being able to set a tone for practice. One of the things that becomes incredibly important is your practice time, right? We don't have the hours in the summer that Division I, II have. We don't have, we just have to use our time really well. And the tone of practice and how that gets set, to me, to in our program at least, really falls on our captains, on our leaders. Like, they have to be able to articulate in the locker room during the dynamic warm-up how important each day is. And unfortunately for them, they can have a kind of a bad day on the court, maybe in terms of missing shots or maybe feeling like they don't play well, but they can't really have a bad day from a connectivity piece. You know, you have to have a great presence about you despite what else is going on the floor. Like, you have to be able to be a person that's not easily rattled. And I'm not a big yeller, but I will get after our captains. And so I think, not to make them feel, not in a bad way, not to single them out, but they do have a little extra responsibility. And then they go to your, so the tone becomes really important, I think, Mike, in how we set practice, the types of learning that takes place, and allowing that environment to be one that we're constantly growing in. And if our captains and if our leaders can be people that allow maybe their play to not bother how they are demeanor-wise, I think that that's really helpful in games, because hey, there's so many ebbs and flows in the course of the game. You just have to have a pretty steady heartbeat. And in timeout, out of timeout, something could be frazzled. A teammate could yell at you. You got to be able to it's got to be water off a turtle's back sometimes. And if you yell back, or if you slump your shoulders, or if you can't look somebody in the eye, I just think that doesn't help a team sink, get out of a hole, right? And your captains really have to be the best people in those moments for me. They usually, hopefully, ideally, they're your best players too, but I don't know if that's always the case. And then the communication component is all the things that you mentioned. It's the lingering. We use that term a lot, like who lingers and practice after practice, who comes before a little bit, who lingers in the weight room, who is the last person on the bus as you're picking up, you know, the pizza boxes and the Chipotle wrappers. And you can just kind of talk to them and you, hey, how did you think that went? What do you think we could do better? Where are we missing something? Who are we missing? Are we missing anybody? And those captains and those leaders have to be really attentive to, they have to have a pretty high emotional IQ. They have to be attentive to everybody on the roster. And that's a big responsibility. And that's not a responsibility that everybody wants to have. But it's a responsibility that we ask our players, our captains to have. And that means that you're going to take somebody out for coffee and you're going to chat with them. And they're not reporting back to me. They're just being a really invested teammate. And, you know, from my standpoint, the communication comes with our beginning of the year meeting, our role meetings. We usually have individual meetings with our players every 10 days during the season. You know, out of season, our contact's pretty limited and there isn't a ton of basketball talk that goes on, but there might be just some leadership chat, some leadership check-in. And for me, the off season, so to speak, in the summertime is a little bit more fishing around and seeing who might be someone that in a year or two could evolve or develop into a type of leader that we want. So we're always kind of looking about 2 years in advance. And you're just kind of asking them some questions and maybe throwing a scenario out and how would you handle that? Is that something that you like? Do you like having a voice? Do you like talking to your teammates? Sometimes I get surprised at the answers sometimes, Mike, honestly.
Yeah, I'm sure
you know, you're like, whoa, okay. But I do think you're just trying to, get a sense for who the person is from a, can they move other people in a good way standpoint. And to me, that's the thing. And everybody says it. It is so true, right? I mean, it's got to be a player-led team is just better than a coach-led team. And it makes for a better experience. I think the results probably speak for themselves probably a little better. Although that's a super, yeah, that's not a statement that probably can be qualified by any specific numbers, but I think the overall, the it just goes better. And that's our, I think part of our job is to equip and mentor our players for life after college. And I don't think there's a better gift you can try to give your players than the gift of leading. And we have wonderful women in our program who will do amazing things when they leave. And that could be a leader of a nursing unit on a floor. It could be a leader in a church group. It could be, you know, the leader as a mother in a family. And you made the same at Waynesburg with our men there. So yeah, I think that's a philosophy that we've continued to hone in on. And hopefully it's a way that we show our players how much we care about them.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
That relationship piece, I think, is clearly so important when you start talking about, we're trying to develop kids, not just as basketball players. We're trying to develop them as people and eventually equip them with the tools that they need to leave the college environment, go out into the quote unquote real world and have success, both as people with their careers and their families, whatever they ultimately want to do. I think that good coaches, that's on their mind. In addition to, obviously, at the college level, like, you're eventually judged by your wins and losses, but a big part of what you do is still being able to use the game of basketball to have an impact on young people that you get an opportunity to coach. Let's talk a little bit of basketball-specific stuff. When you think about practice design, how do you go about putting together a practice? Does one of your practices always kind of have the same feel? Are you changing it up day to day? Just what's your philosophy on putting together a great practice, and what do you hope to get out of a great practice?
I would like our practices to be as competitive as possible every day. And so that's kind of the framework that we operate from. Certainly there's going to be skill development. So that's not probably different from a lot of people, right? First 15 minutes to 20 minutes, it's a great opportunity for your assistants to get hand on a ball and to see the eyes of your players as well and kind of get a sense for where they're at. So I can sit and watch, or I can be involved in something as well. But, you know, that first 15 minutes is a great opportunity for your assistants to speak and for our players to hear their voices. Generally, transition D becomes really important, especially early in the year. We spend a lot of time there in that organization. And then, yeah, your scheme, you know, just both things. I think we end up playing a lot of 5-on-5. I've probably evolved in the sense that when I was a younger coach, you know, you love the conditioning drills. And then you might text or talk to people about, oh man, this guy puked and we got this person running and it was great. I think we've pivoted away from a lot of that, and we just try to do things that happen in the game a lot, and we play a lot. And for me, that becomes really important. Like, we want to hone in on the stuff in the game that happens a lot and teach our players different reads and how to react in those scenarios and what we're looking for and the footwork necessary to succeed. I think we try to break it down in those moments. So we, you know, a lot of 10 minute segments, a lot of not me talking. And we might have something at the end of that 10 minute segment where we're, hey, we really have to do this footwork piece well. But, and we try to shoot a lot. I think since I've been back at Calvin, we have tried to get our players 100 to 125 shots of practice in various ways, like pretty much all catch and shoot stuff. So in addition to the free throws and some of the other things that they're able to do. So it's a kind of a big goal. But I think like that becomes really important. So it just kind of emphasizes, hey, as competitive as you can. So we're mixing teams for the most part, pretty much every day. And you're trying to see different combinations. And then, you know, as you hone into a starting group, you know, they'll play a little bit more together, but we still want practice to be really competitive. And if I think there's a big gap between maybe the top eight and the next nine, well, we're probably going to mix most of the time. And then we'll have the starters play, you know, a day or two before a game, because I don't want to trade the competitiveness for the rhythm. And I know, you know, that might change from year to year. So, and, you know, there's we have special situations every day that we get into, whether it's baseline out of bounds or sideline out. So I think generally the practices flows pretty much the same structure wise, the drills and how you get to it probably are a little different. But for me, the competitive component of practice is paramount. And then the next thing is really honing in on the stuff in the game that happens a lot and doing that.
So how do you plan that out? What's your process during the day or the day before? Or how do you think about, okay, so we practiced on a Monday, now we go to practice on Tuesday. How do you go from Monday's practice to Tuesday's practice? Where are you when you're designing the practice? Are you writing it out? Are you typing it? What's the process?
Yep. So I write it. So from one day to the next, so I'll write the weekly plan the week before. In terms of the types of things that we really need to get to. So, and those are probably big picture pieces. So, hey, is, you know, zone O, we got to make sure that we put in our press break. We got to get our out of timeout situation ready. We got to make sure we know who's inbounding the ball. And we got to, you know, so you have big picture things that I write. So yellow legal notepads are like, I probably have six of them on my desk in the office. And you're just going, you're filling them up and you're going. I always use pencil initially as I kind of make the weekly plan. Then when we get into Monday, say, in the day of a practice, in the office, then it becomes a little bit more detailed. And we have a drill book. You're just kind of going through your list of drills that you kind of feel like that could be something that works for what you want to accomplish on that day, whether it's high, low footwork, whether it's post passing, whether it's passing out of traps, whether it is balls, you know, obviously ball screen coverage but not only ball screen coverage, but how you guard the ball, on the perimeter and your angles and your feet and your hands, all become really important, right? So it's kind of scribbling it out a little bit and I'll cross it out a fair amount in terms of putting things where, and then the order becomes important to me too. Like the order of the drill, I would like to make sure that the stuff that I feel is really important is probably in the middle of practice, because I think that's when our players are probably at their peak concentration level after the dynamic and after, you know, maybe some of the first 15 minute skill work and after a transition D drill, then that next half hour to 40 minutes for us in a 2 hour practice become gold. And that is, that's where we really got to hone in on the stuff, communication, to the lingo, to maybe the install of something. To me, that's usually where we put that. And then you'll finish with something really competitive and kind of a finisher practice, so they feel good about accomplishing something right before they leave. And so I'll write it out and I'll write out the teams and then I'll type it out. I have a template, you know, to type it out so it's clean. I think my players would say that, they can't read my handwriting. I don't know if I can read my handwriting usually. So the typing becomes way better. And then we post it every day in the locker room so people know what's going on. And I would say, Mike, as practice is going on, I make notes on my practice plan. So in real life, so like maybe the horn goes, they get a quick drink and I'm writing down we have to change this on this. I don't want to see these two people playing together again for a couple of days. You know, we have to do this and this. Like, so then that note sheet from the day's practice can help drive and start the next day. I do want to say, and from a practice standpoint, and one of the challenges is, and we say this, and we really try to do it, like, we want to honor our players' time. They are, they're students. They have a lot going on. Basketball is a long season. And when we say we're going to practice from 5:30 to 7:30, as a coach, we need to be done at 7:30, because that's what I told them. And I know there are probably times that I wish I wouldn't say that. I'd put 7:50.
right.
But I have to be okay with being done and honoring their time. That's a way to develop trust, right? And so that becomes really important. It also becomes a challenge as you get closer to games and there's more stuff, but that's why you prep. And I feel like if you can prep it out weekly, I know coaches who do it monthly. I have a hard time with that. I have a hard time getting that far ahead of myself, because I, especially with a newer group this year, I'm not exactly sure how quickly we'll be able to progress through some things. And I just want to make sure that we're going at the pace that we can go at with this group that makes the most sense. And so to me, the weekly plan, you know, I will do our weekly plan next week. We have three practices. I'll do it tomorrow. And then, you know, Monday morning, we'll be able to hone it out and be ready to go with a pretty detailed plan Monday afternoon for practice.
I've heard different coaches have different thoughts about posting the practice plan in the locker room so your team can see it before practice. And I've heard coaches that have said they don't like to post it. So I'm just curious as to sort of your thought process behind why you do post it. What do you think are the benefits to letting your players see that going into practice?
I am not concerned about them pacing themselves, because I'll see it. Now, we don't get to wear the catapult vests and have the numbers on the board in terms of your heart rate and your output and your energy level and all that stuff. But we see it. And I go by the clearest kind. I want our players to know what team they're on. I want them to know what we're working on and what the emphasis of the day is. If they see we have four transition D drills, when they walk out of that locker room, they know that we're pretty serious about that. And that's going to be an area that we're going to get better in immediately. When they see a lot of shooting, they probably smile. It's going to be great. It's going to be a good one. So I feel like that, to me, is a way as a coach that I can, just continue the conversation. Like, I want our players to have some input into practice sometimes. Hey, what do you think we need? How are we feeling? To me, I think the posting of the plan, and I think it helps with our common language. So when we're talking about a fast break drill that we have a name for, or another drill that we do, that, you know, our new players get to know the names quickly of the drills. They can associate, and they might not like it. That's fine. But I'm not worried about the pacing, and I'm really not a big surprise puller in practice. Like, our job, I feel like, as a coach, is to give our players the answers to the test, right? If a game is the test, they have to know everything before we go play that game. And to me, posting a practice plan, they can see the design, they can see the emphasis. They also then they know that I'm not full of it either, that I'm not making it up. Like, this is here. Like, they know, and they know when we're going to start and when we're going to end. To me, that, it's kind of a scary thought to go into something when you're not sure how long it's going to be, and what comes next. I don't want our players to feel that. So that's why. And again, everybody's got their own thing. I totally get it. But that's kind of where we're coming from with practice.
That makes sense.
and thinking about it from a player perspective, I feel like you know what you're about to get into. And to your point, when you're able to put down on the practice plan sort of what those points of emphasis are going to be, where there's, hey, we're going to do four drills in this particular area, then as a player, I can kind of get myself ready for, yeah, I know that I got to be on point when it comes to this. And so it completely makes sense to me. Let's shift gears from practice to game day. In your mind, what makes for a perfect game day? When you start thinking about what you do as a coach to get yourself mentally prepared, to have your team mentally prepared. So kind of from, I mean, I know there's a lot of things that go into it before the actual game day, but when you wake up in the morning on game day, if you could design the perfect day, what would that look like?
A little exercise. It's always good. Something that I always have to continue to remind. I feel like I do well out of season. In fact, I do really well out of season. I think it's easy, it's hard to do in season sometimes, but game days are great for that, actually. So a little exercise is always good. I spend time going back through just some of the specials of the opponent. So when we do our scout, you know, we always want to try to get, you know, 3 to 4 games. Not always, I mean, certainly the most recent two, and then maybe if there's a common opponent or you played them the first time and you're playing them a second time, to go back through, you know, at least that. And then obviously there's some player specific stuff, but for me, I don't want our players don't have to know everything, but I like to know what they might do out of a timeout with women's, the college game, right? The quarter breaks become important to win, try to win those segments. Do they do anything off of free throw? Do they do anything? When do they incorporate, if they're going to play zone, when might that be? So for me, like I try to go back and look through, and I'll spend just an hour in the morning of the day of our game, just kind of going back through some special things that I can be aware of as the head coach. And so that I can remind our players of, and then I'll make notes. So, and I have a game card that I'll just write out. And it involves all our, it's like a play sheet, right? So it has all our play calls, has our set families. It has a few notes on maybe what we want to run in certain situations. And that's game specific. It has the lineup, our starters, who's available for us. It has, you know, baseline out of bounds, sideline out of bounds, our specials. And it has defensive notes. So, probably specific ball screen coverages, things to look out for. I don't have the plays on that card that a team might run, but we do print those out, and then an assistant would have it in a clipboard. So, and those are printed, so I don't have to. We don't have to draw them. We just show them and show our players in a timeout. Like, hey, this is an ATO. Just take a look. It wouldn't be the first time that they see it, but it's just a reminder. And then I'm kind of visualizing the game, how the game is going to go on that night, and not maybe the scoring as much as the flow of the game. Like when am I going to need to call a timeout? What happens if this person gets hurt? Who is playing if this person fouls out? What are we going to run at the end of a game? And that I might just do a little practice on the whiteboard drawn, just so I feel like I can do it well when push comes to shove. And so it's for me, the game day is it's an exercise. It's trying to get a good meal early, because then probably within 6 or 7 hours, I'm not eating until after. And you're really mentally rehearsing how the game's going to go. And then, you know, hopefully there aren't too many distractions of tickets or a pass list or whatever, but occasionally there's stuff like that that you have to kind of deal with a little bit on game day too. But and then if it's a road game where there, you try to get there an hour and a half before, if it's home, yeah, just kind of saunter down to the locker room and right before our players get in there. And then I just pace. I usually get my steps for the day. We'll say that.
There you go. Do you have a superstition?
I do not. I don't think so. I, No, but I do go through, I think I went through 4 big packs of Ricola cough drops from Costco last year. So it's about 420. So I need to have some cough drops with me. So I don't know if that's a superstition as much as it is a comfort. Like I have to have 5 or 6 in my pocket. So
understood. Interesting. Yeah. It's funny how everybody has their, when I was coaching in high school, I coached with the same staff for, I don't know, like 10 or 12 years, same 3 guys. And we would always have on the bench during games, our head coach and then our other assistant, they'd each have a Diet Pepsi and I'd always have a Pepsi. And we would always have those on the bench underneath the seats, whatever. And again, I don't know if I would have called it a superstition, kind of like you, but it was just something that, we had, that we did. I don't remember when it started or how it started, but it was like, hey, who's getting the Pepsis tonight, you know? And so it's just one of those things that it just kind of became, hey, this is what we do. This is how we do it. So it's interesting how we all do things. We all do things a little bit differently. All right, I want to ask a final 2-part question here as we come up on an hour and a half. So first part of the question is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, as you said, this is kind of a key moment for you with the program to be able to continue to build and sustain the success you've had. So what do you see as being your biggest challenge in the next year or two? And then the second part of the question is, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
That's our biggest challenge, Mike. You know, it's interesting. One of the things to come back to Calvin, I think you always want to be at a place where you feel like you can win, right? And you can win. I feel like we can win a national championship here now. There's so much stuff that goes into that, that it's not something that we talk about a lot. But I think for us, like the challenge continues to be, to be in the mix, feel like we're in the mix nationally, meaning we have to beat teams in our league that have been in the mix nationally. And so I think we haven't done that yet. And I think the challenge is to try to continue to close the gap and to get the result against, 2 league teams that we haven't beaten yet. It's kind of hard to probably describe the Calvin Hope rivalry, but that, I think coaching at Calvin and I've never coached at Hope, so I don't know, but that is something that is a little more all consuming than people might realize. And you could have a great year in a sport. But if you lose to Hope, I think the general consensus is maybe you didn't have a great year, and I'm, right. And you could be really good. And, we usually get, they had 2,900 folks at the volleyball match between the two last night. There's for our standpoint, there's a fair amount of attention. It's a really fun game to play. And trying on the women's side for women's basketball has also been really good. And so the challenge for us, I think, in the next year is to continue to close the gap. And honestly, for me, that means our culture is strong and that we're recruiting the right people and that we're developing the right people. And we're just going to continue to go. I do have a picture of the Chad LeClos, Michael Phelps race. I think it was London. I don't know. I think it was the London Olympics 2012, but there's French swimmer, Chad LeClos. He was almost to the finish line, but he was looking over at Phelps and Phelps passes him in the last 2 yards, right, to out touch him and to get the gold medal. And it's just a great reminder of, you gotta look in your own lane here a little bit. So that's a challenge, honestly, not compare yourself to other folks that have had success and other programs that, that continue to do things really well, because I feel like we do it really well. I think I love our players. I love working at Calvin. To be coaching at your alma mater is really special. We have a coaching body at Calvin in our athletic department that is really awesome. We have lunch together. We support one another. I feel like we have conversations where we kind of know what's going on in the teams without being invasive. And I think this, to be at a place that where your colleagues really support you and know you and support your players is awesome. It's a great feeling. And it's really, really fun. And, you know, I've been fortunate to be able to do this for, this will be year 22 as an assistant head coach at the Division III level. And, you know, I'm really grateful for the people that have poured into me and that have encouraged me and the relationships that I have. You know, even looking through your guest list of previous guests, you know, Steve Lamb, he's a really good friend of mine. And we had some really good battles when I was in the President's Athletic Conference. And Mike DeWitt was a great mentor for me when I was a young coach at Waynesburg. And we had a really good relationship. And, you know, Jason Leone at Oswego is just a really good coach and a really good guy. You know, and so you have those relationships that you have professionally. And then, but to be at a place where you have some personal relationships too with your coaching colleagues is really rewarding. And they can see the work that you put in to your team and they can acknowledge that. And you can kind of walk through that professional life together, which is pretty neat. So I'm really thankful for that. And that brings me a great amount of joy to represent Calvin and to be a member of our coaching body here.
That's really well said, Mark. And I think it speaks to, again, kind of the theme of what we talked about throughout the podcast, right? It's the relationships. It's the ability to have an impact on the young people that you're touching every single day. You're having an impact on their lives and helping them to grow as basketball players, but ultimately also as people. So before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can get in touch with you, find out more about your program, whether you want to share email, social media, website, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't do a lot on X anymore, but it was at Coach Christner is my X address. We'll put some content up as we get into some games and get a little bit more into practice. My email is my name, mark.christner@calvin.edu. Yeah, Calvin Women's Basketball, from a schedule standpoint and from a website standpoint, it's just calvinknights.com. And then you can search through women's basketball and find us. We are a place that loves to have people come watch practice. We are always open to having people come watch us play. We've had a lot of people come through and we're thankful for the people that show an interest in us and in the women's game. You know, there's a lot of attention on the women's game with what happened last year in the Division I National Championship in the tournament and the players that are back. And I know the WNBA's had really good ratings and little expansion going on with Portland in the Bay Area. So that's pretty cool. I think the women's game is growing. I would say this, Mike, the game it's different, right, than the men's. So the strategy of the quarters and using some of that stuff to your advantage is really fun. So I would encourage folks who listen to, you know, that there's a lot of great small college women's basketball, especially in Ohio and Michigan and Indiana and Illinois, Wisconsin. We generally, not to be arrogant, but I feel like it's a place that generally produces a national champ or two every once in a while at the Division III level and certainly at the Division II level too. So if you're close to a program, you know, Ashland or, you know, Transylvania and Lexington, like go watch. It's really good, really good stuff. So I appreciate you having me on, Mike. And I appreciate the folks who listen to this and people like you who try to share the game to a broader audience. Really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Mark. And again, I know that I speak for Jason when I just say that one of the things that we enjoy is getting to talk to coaches at all different levels of the game. And obviously talking to coaches on the men's side, coaches on the women's side. And really, we've just been fortunate to be able to be associated with such great people that have been willing to come on like yourself and talk to us about what they do, how they do it, and just share their successes and their stories, which hopefully, again, for our audience of coaches that's out there listening, hopefully what you get out of these episodes is something that can help you to grow as a coach. And ultimately for me, I think just being able to pour something back into the game of basketball that's been so good to me is really what it's been all about. So again, thank you, Mark. We really appreciate your time tonight. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.